Okay, let's say our opening prayer. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Dearest Mother,
Beloved David,
Beloved David,
and saints and sages of all religions,
Saints and sages of all
I
religions,
bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles
Free my life from all obstacles.
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king,
Be thou the only king,
reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peace,
Peace,
bliss,
bliss.
amen.
Amen.
All right, let's do a short meditation. Such a beautiful voice. I'm going to play a little video of a man who met Padre Pio. Kate and I got quite uplifted watching it, and seems quite appropriate to get a chance to watch it.
I was coming from Australia after 39 days on a boat. And I stopped at Naples and went to San Giovanni Rotondo. I want to visit Padre Pio, not because of Padre Pio, but because of the phenomenon of this man having the wounds of Jesus. I was just curious. So I was there one day, and I went to the sacristan, and I said, is it possible I could go to confession to Padre Pio? Yes, he says, but you have to wait 3 weeks. It was all by appointment. And well, I said, I have to leave tomorrow. I don't have much time. Well, he said, what you can do is wait around. If somebody's name is called and they don't turn up, you can go in. So, being Sicilian, I belong to the mafia. And so I waited, and somebody's name was called, and they didn't turn up. So I sneaked in. As soon as I walked in, Padre Pio shouted off the top of his voice. And I hadn't made my confession yet. Could you imagine, had I made my confession, he would have kicked me out. So he starts shouting, he says, you are here abusively. Meaning, I didn't follow the system. I didn't wait for my appointment. You are here abusively. I nearly froze. I nearly walked out. Because I said, well, he's shouting already. Then he says to me, you are here because you enter in the seminary, but you will find it very difficult in your studies. And but you'll persevere. And that was the case. I made my confession, and then I couldn't wait to get out of the confessional because I was trembling. Yeah? So I had a brand new camera while I was coming home, or coming to Italy from Australia. I was teaching little children some catechism. So at the end of the trip, they gave me a camera, Yashica camera, brand new. And there at St. Padre Pio's, where he was staying, there were the church and the hospitals and all the stuff. And I took photos of everything. In the church, there was a sign in five languages saying, do not take photos. So I said, just in case, in five languages, it was in five languages. So I said, just in case somebody says, don't take photos, I just say, I'm sorry, I don't understand those languages. So I took photos of everything. Then I took photos of Padre Pio. Because after the Mass, we were able to go into the sacristy and we could meet him. So he was coming out of the lift. And as he came out of the lift, I took the photo. And then it was those old-fashioned cameras which you heard pull the handle to go to the next film. So I go to push the handle, and it gets stuck. It doesn't work. I take it to the photographer the following day, and I said, this is a brand-new camera. I'm just using it for the first time. He said, you can throw it away because it's not going to work. Okay. So I was going to Rome because I was going to study in Rome. And I took it with me. And when I got to Rome, I took it to the photographer. And he had a look at it. He says, there's nothing wrong with the camera. It's working perfectly well. All the photos I took around the place, church, everything, came out. Aww. All the photos I took of him didn't come out. So going to his life. Padre Pio had the wounds of Jesus, five wounds, and also not everybody knew. Only the superior of the house knew that that Padre Pio had the wound of Jesus also on the shoulder. Jesus carried his cross, but nobody knew about that. Only the superior. And he would hear confessions 16 hours a day. He could tell you everything about yourself. He had the gift of bilocation, the gift of healing, the gift of preaching, the gift of discernment, prophecies, God had given all these beautiful gifts. And so 16 hours a day confession. His mass would last 4 hours. Wow. 4 hours. Because after the consecration, he would go in ecstasy. Meaning he would be at the altar immobile, not moving. And during that time, he would be in 5 different places at the same time. He could be doing a wedding here, a funeral there, visiting the sick. He could be hearing confession over the other side of the world, all over the world at the same time. He could be in 5 different places at the same time. And during the Mass, if you were close to the altar, you could literally see the blood coming down from his hands, dropping on the altar, on the table. And sometimes he would feel the passion of Jesus, and he would cry during the consecration, because the sacrifice of the Mass is a sacrifice, and he will recall the passion of Jesus. Tears would be coming down his face. You could say the greatest suffering for Padre Pio was the Vatican. The Vatican thought that Padre Pio had inflicted the wounds by himself. But he had people from all over the world come in and verify these wounds. And they discovered there was something supernatural, nothing to do with the human beings. So they sent this inquisitor from the Vatican, and the Pope had given him orders that he should stay there at least 1 month to observe everything Padre Pio was doing, people he was meeting, the places he would go. So from 25 hours a day, he was chaperoned by this guy, and observing what he was saying, what he was doing, who he was talking with. Padre Pio was accused of being homosexual. He was accused of being a womanizer. He was accused of manipulating funds. He was accused of doing monkey business. That man had torture for 52 years. And his aim was, I have offered myself as a suffering victim for the conversion of sinners. I have offered myself for my suffering victim for my spiritual children. And he would say, I would wait at the gate of heaven until all my spiritual children have come in. So his life became a suffering victim, losing 1 cup of blood every day, having the stigmatas, feet, hands, and side. And once somebody asked him, Father Pio, are those wounds painful? And he would respond and say, do you think Jesus gave them to me for a toy? He was misunderstood. And this guy, sort of observing what he was doing there for 1 month, at the end of the trip, or the time he was there, he went to Padre Pio and he says, Padre Pio, what do you think of Padre Pio? He said, I am a problem to myself. He wished, he begged the Holy Father. He wanted to go to Rome to visit the Holy Father. Pope John Paul II, when he was still a seminarian, visited Padre Pio. And Padre Pio said to the future Pope John Paul II, one day you'll become a pope. Then one day a woman comes in and goes to confession to him. And he said to this lady, if you had not aborted your child, he would have become a pope. While I was there that morning, while I was waiting for confession, a woman went in and she was not dressed modestly. And Padre Pio would hear men's confessions face to face, and he would hear women's confessions in the confessional. But he could not see the person who it was. So this woman comes in, and she's not modestly dressed. So immediately he said to her, "Go home and get dressed," shouting, top of his voice, "Go home and get dressed." So she walked out of the confessional, and she came from far away, because people would come from all over the world for confessions. And so she rejoined the queue, and Padre Pio could not see her. So when she rejoined the queue, he comes out and he says, "I told you to go home, bitch." That's how he treated them. His confessions would only last 3 minutes, in and out. He could tell you the present, the past, the future. If you, for whatever reason, would not tell everything, he would tell you, "What about that occasion, that day, that time, that sin?" He would tell you all your all your sins. Extraordinary man. He was never allowed to leave the monastery. For 52 years, he was destined to stay there, San Giovanni Rotondo, where he received the stigmatas. For 52 years, that was his journey. And all because he, the Mass, just to attend his Mass, would be one of the most unforgettable experience. He would say, "I can live without the sun all my life, but I cannot live one day without the Mass."
I do want to bring this one up too. It's a very, very interesting story. But my theme, discussing is the remarkable aspects of the human life that we all have, and the capabilities that exist in the human being, human life here. You know, the what Padre Pio was able to do, bilocation, all these things that great saints can do, they really are quite remarkable in the idea of what is possible and why our own lives don't have some of these gifts of the Spirit. So this is short here. There's five people that are being discussed here, and only I just want you to listen to this first one. And I think he's like 3 to 5 minutes or so. This is quite a remarkable person, but this is an interesting video, and I'll put the link to this when we put it up on the website. Oh, so I'll put this link for both these videos, and you can watch the other ones, because there are five people, or six or maybe, that are really, it boggles the mind what people can do. There's one guy who learned to speak Icelandic in 1 week. They could do amazing math in their minds, and they could see things synesthesia. You know, Sri Yukteswar talks about in the holy science that different sciences can different people, senses can be overlapped with other senses. You can hear with your eyes and see with your ears, or these are the kinds of stories that are told. And this person, they have scientific evidence of that this is a fact, that this kind of things do happen. And he would do math in his mind, but it would come up as colors and symbols, or not symbols, but shapes and colors, and he could do math using those. It's very, very strange what the mind is. Padre Pio was really quite unusual, the type of person, but many saints can tell you things about your own life. And so, I mean, this is something that saints have. I always felt Mother knew so much about me. We have lots of evidence of Master, even from Mother, but many other stories. Mother's stories are a little more circumspect. She didn't like to promote this idea of looking for powers. So she downplayed whatever she could see. She let God give it to her, and she always insisted, and David did too, that anything that God gave them was for the person who's before them, and so it would be used. But Padre Pio was really extraordinary that way. But just listen to this crazy story here, And just to stretch your mind into seeing, all of our minds, into seeing what is possible in the human, as a human incarnation.
Kim Peek. Kim Peek memorized 12,000 books word for word and could not button his own shirt. He could read two pages at once, one with each eye, in seconds, and keep almost every word for the rest of his life. He also could not dress himself or understand a simple joke. When Kim was born in 1951, doctors examined his oversized head and told his parents he was severely brain damaged. They advised the family to put him in an institution and forget he existed. The reason was real. Scans later showed that Kim had been born without a corpus callosum, the thick bundle of nerves that connects the left and right halves of the brain and lets them talk to each other. Kim's two hemispheres were, in a sense, working alone. But instead of destroying his mind, something about that missing connection seemed to rewire it into something almost superhuman. Kim began memorizing everything. He could read two facing pages of a book at the same time, one page with his left eye, the other with his right, in a matter of seconds, and retain nearly all of it forever. He absorbed entire encyclopedias. He knew maps of thousands of cities from memory, every zip code, every highway, every area code in the United States. Ask him any date in history, and he could tell you the day of the week and what happened. People called him a living library. And yet, in daily life, he needed constant help. He struggled with abstract ideas, with ordinary conversation, with the simplest self-care. The same brain that held 12,000 books could not manage the small mechanics of getting dressed. He became world famous as the inspiration for the film Rain Man, and he spent his later years traveling the country, meeting people, quietly astonishing everyone he met. A scientist who studied him put it plainly. Until we understand Kim Peek, he said, we cannot pretend to understand human thought at all.
So this this is how this goes from one person after another. I think it is maybe worth watching the very end one, if you'll bear with me.
Expected return of a person's full mind right before death. Consider what that means. There are people who, through advanced dementia or Alzheimer's disease, have effectively been lost for years. They no longer recognize their own children. They cannot speak or hold a thought or respond to the world. The disease has physically destroyed large parts of their brains, and doctors will tell you, correctly, that this damage does not reverse. What is gone is gone. And yet, again and again, in cases documented by doctors and nurses and hospice workers across the world, something impossible happens. In the hours or days before death, the person comes back. A woman with severe Alzheimer's who has not recognized her daughter in 6 years suddenly looks up, calls her by name, speaks warmly and clearly, remembers, connects, says goodbye. Then, usually within hours, she dies. The mind returns for one last conversation through a brain that should no longer be capable of it, and then it is gone for good. It has been recorded since ancient times, and it was given its name to terminal lucidity only recently, as science began to take it seriously. And that is the problem. Nobody can explain it. The brain tissue that would be needed for that clarity has, in many cases, been physically ravaged by disease. There is no accepted mechanism for how a mind can switch back on, briefly and brilliantly, in a body that is shutting down. For the families who witness it, it is a final, precious gift. For science, it is one of the deepest, unsolved mysteries of the human mind.
So this, of course, goes back to the constant discussion that all the spiritual teachings discuss, and that is consciousness. Because what else can explain the last thing there about terminal lucidity? What else can explain that other than the fact that the soul is what stores things, the Atman, if you want to look at it from that point of view. From the Indian point of view, these are interchangeable words. They have slight modifications to them in each language, but we're all dealing with the same thing. These are well-known facts. And you don't, if you have the mechanical notion that the brain is what comes up with consciousness, as I said just recently, it doesn't explain someone leaving their body and knowing what's being said in the room. Or even leaving and going astral projection and reporting back what was going on someplace else. This is well discussed, and each one of us could probably have some people more very dramatic experiences with these kinds of things. We shouldn't be afraid of them. We shouldn't be surprised at them. that these are part of the spiritual teachings that we have, that these fit into the spiritual teachings that we have. And so we can use the brain for so many things. Now, I've often wondered, you know, there's gradations of saints. And what is it about Padre Pio? He had great compassion. I mean, he truly did. He was amazing, remarkable person, doing all those 16 hours a day in the confessional because people wanted to have that interaction with him. And then the stories of him going into ecstasy and lost to the world, bilocating. Now, we're pretty clear that these things are really highly developed souls who can do them, but this is not the highest state. He may have been in the highest state and manifesting the things that he did for God's own reasons. I don't know. Once you get to that level, you have some proofs of it with Jesus' story, raising people from the dead, turning water into wine, walking on the water. But those things are, we're told, not to be tried to, attempted to, or to learn to do whatever it takes to get those powers. And, you know, Master talked about that man who could generate a smell. So we could spend a lot of effort into these things with studying them and, doing ascetic things. You have to be a fairly developed soul to be able to access these things. Many people go and they study and they stay in the forest for up in the Himalayas and for decades and get no benefit, no tools, no powers of that sort. But some people, I mean, these are all where reincarnation and the journey of the soul and what this physical plane is all about, that has to explain, much to explain about why it seems to be capricious how God is in his giving these powers and giving these ways of getting them for people who aren't ready. Mother liked to push away from all of those things she didn't want to have people who were just coming for those reasons. Many people did see her, you know, just a ball of light around her. So there were things, but people, it gets interesting too that we all have these different kinds of experiences, true spiritual experiences, and we slowly talk ourselves with enough time out of it. It's too bad, but it is the human nature to let things that aren't with our daily basis. You know, when you have an epiphany or you have a short-term wonder, the thing happens that really makes you wonder, and an ecstatic state or things like that, we can talk ourselves out of them, saying that they're not as great or did that really happen? We lose our interest in it. But I like to point out here that I want to point out how these things are all available to us. Then it's probably the higher yugas. We do have, you know, there's evidence that in some of the things that Master and Sri Yukteswar talked about, that in the higher yugas, people can have telepathy. And, you know, David and I have always, I'm not sure if we got this from Mother, but we've always had thought that during the Treta Yuga or the Satya Yuga, certainly, that, you know, it was the end of the Treta Yuga where the Tower of Babel, what happened, where people have to languages, different, God confused the languages. And we've just often thought, well, these things are practical in nature. Perhaps it is that before that, when you had more intuition and more telepathic communication, you didn't need to have a specific language from a specific region with the using the voice to transmit information. So this world that we're living in now, we come across someone like Padre Pio and we recognize that as being quite remarkable. And again, I don't know with him whether he was fully realized or not. Doesn't matter. He was tremendous saint and tremendous power for good in the world. But that we shouldn't feel limited in our what we can do. We can cure people. We can pray for people. And we can, we have tremendous influence in the world if we would but use it. And you can better attune yourself to make it stronger You can do that sort of thing. It's one of the best things we can do. It's comforting to know that there's yogis in the Himalayas and there's nuns and monks in monasteries and convents that are praying for the, you know, they, Catholics always do it for the praying for the conversion of the unbaptized, and that's fine. But for us, we would say praying for the good of making the greatest good for all concerned. And so we have much more power than we can, than we normally think of. We see these limitations imposed upon us, and we think that, that these kinds of things, it's easiest just to say it's not possible, like the scientists, or the, I should say the atheist scientists do, and the atheist materialists do. They say that it's just not possible. That's, so it's a stupid thing for you to tell me stories about Padre Pio, because we know it's not possible until the stories were made up or imagined or something, but it's not. So that way, what's convenient about that is it does get your mind focused in the material realm. And if you have a great work to do in the material realm, Galileo and Isaac Newton, other great scientists, these people, you know, maybe the soul might be greater, been had higher states, or, you know, states that are revealed states of consciousness that were higher in other lifetimes. But they may have come for this very reason. I've always thought that the time of the great operas and classical music during the, you know, from 1700s forward, there was about a 200-year period where these tremendous musicians and musical masters existed, and they all came together and they lived at the same time. And people who needed, these people, composers, need a lot of people to get together to do one of these great works. So God also made it so lots of people would spend their long, long number of parts of years of their life, you know, learning to play the tuba, the trombone, the piano, all the instruments in a orchestra. So there's, you know, tremendous number of souls who had come at the same time. And music has probably always been with us, but the craftsmanship that was due in the building of these instruments on a scale where everyone could have a violin, or many people could. They could have a flute. They could have these things, these material things that were built by expert craftsmen. So these things all come together at different times. I think what we're going through now is that there is definitely a great technical renaissance going on now. And that we are seeing something great happening, but I really see us as being such a state of flux that we're seeing. We have to recognize that there's great hope for the future as well. But when you're in a state of flux and straight and the great change like we're in now, and we're talking, you know, hundreds of years, but intensifying amounts of adjustment and change that's wreaking havoc with the families and the society. Much suffering goes on in the world now, of a different type than just being subject to wars and things like that, violence. And there was plenty of that too. But there's something about St. Francis and St. Padre Pio and some of these saints that really draws us to them. Master's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, he himself was a great, great, perfect master. But his book always talked about other masters that he knew, demonstrating and showing people with his refined understanding what these different saints were and how they reacted to him too. Fun stuff. You know, Yogananda, Paramahansa Yogananda was truly, truly unique in his life, because he didn't paint himself as this great master that he was. I mean, stories about him abound by people who knew him. But in his book, it's a seminal book. It's a huge book. He doesn't use it for ego. He uses it to teach, to enlighten, to lift our consciousness to the possibility of these great powers. I mean, there are so many miraculous things that he did. I always felt with Mother that Mother did things differently with regard to that, and her miracles were in her taking care of people. I don't mean to say that we didn't have any major problems, but it seemed like the play that was going around Mother was she was constantly taking care of people and situations. You know, Master had that young boy in that story we just heard. Wish I could remember was, if anyone remembers where it was, that little boy lost the tips of his fingers. But before that, he had walked up to Master and touched him. And Master picked him up and hugged him. And later, when the fingers were lost in some kind of an accident, he said that he knew that was going to happen, but that his the boy coming to him and then maybe the soul knowing he needed help and him being lifted into that, the power that Master had, it's just mind-boggling. And whether he could raise someone from a dead, I have no doubt. Look what he did with his own life. I mean, to complete a poem to the last word and exit his body the way he left, what a shining example he was. And subtle, very, very low-key approach to things. And we do love these great masters. They mean so much to us. We want to be in that state ourselves. And so they give us something to look forward to, something to climb for. The only thing that's unique about Mother, too, is that, and she would talk in this way, but she didn't hold out doing things of a lower state that are just for themselves being done. Again, great masters manifest these things even though they're fully realized. So it's very difficult to know what each of these saints, what state they're in. But Mother held out the highest state for all of us. And she pushed people out who weren't part of her, who she didn't want to deal with, or she was finished with her the work that she had to do. We saw her push people out, and we saw people not come that we thought would. They could be exposed to her. They could be benefit from her, but she could make it so they wouldn't come back if they weren't part of her close-in disciples. For whatever reason, we don't know. Yeah, and, you know, she wouldn't advertise. She wouldn't form an organization. So she didn't leave any material things other than her tapes and her writings, of course. But these things are, that's more intellectual property. But she left nothing to fight over. So she really did just want us to focus on, you know, to focus on just the highest. Go to the president of the universe. Don't mess with Mr. In Between. I was thinking how these kinds of powers and things that we can want to have and to show off to other people, how they can be so much an ego boost that you can spend long time diverted into it. I think this world is some place that we want to experience all of these things. And it probably comes from great desires from other lifetimes. If you think about a person who'd spend his life as a slave or a servant, you know, a person working on an estate, working in a factory his whole life. And we have so much more freedom nowadays and more likelihood of getting, of moving up higher. But most of the time, even in the modern, more modern Western world, people didn't have much hope and didn't have much plans to either. It wasn't a big deal to go beyond a stable hand, to become a butler all of those things. But it does leave the soul knowing about the higher things, having working for someone who's wealthy and has all these fancy cars or trains or planes, all of those kinds of helicopters. All those kinds of things are pretty exciting. And so it lays in the person's mind as to desire. And spiritual people can spend many lifetimes or a lifetime or two really devoted, but in held deeply within them is this desire to have a family, to live in the normal as a normal person, and to move away from the spiritual world and the confining nature of the spiritual world in close proximity to others is a crucifixion type. Let's call it a crucible, which is a nice word we're using a lot lately. And it becomes a crucible, and you just endure, and you get to a certain age and you realize you're going to die in that place. And so you just relax your intentions and your expectations, or you rail against time and you rail against everything. Different things are available for everyone. But these are the things that lay the seeds. If you're not in a pure enough state, and again, these are kind of negative terms, I'd rather not think that way. I'd rather think that we have planned so much of this, and we have these desires that we implant in ourselves, and we keep ourselves ensnared. We have to get beyond thinking that God is doing this to us. He's putting us here. I say that all the time myself. So I'm talking to myself, but because I do feel as though God does these things, but he does it through my agency. That's the part that's not understood. And I think it's so important to take ownership, to take accountability in all things that we've received, all difficulties we've been faced with, all the problems in our life, in our face, in our body, in our all aspects of our bodies. These things try men's souls, but they work on something specific. They chip away at something specific. You know, I've been thinking about mothers and writing mother's biography. And one of the things, you know, I've been thinking about this for many years, and that was her time at the ashram. You know, in 96, when I went to the ashram, I interviewed Swami Sahasrananda for that reason, expecting to write a book about her and to get these people before they passed away, to get them all recorded and have some idea what it was like. One thing that seems clear with mother's experience at the ashram with Papa is that there is an aspect of her fall from grace there within the eyes of the community there. I think what I was surprised about is the people who did know Mother, except for Swami Sachidananda, they didn't think she'd attained anything. And Papa, Mataji, Swamiji never, you know, straightened anybody out. And I think there may have even been some doubt. I'll tell you this aspect there. And I might be the way I'll start the book. I think it's so important. It's certainly a way that can be told. Tell Mother's story. She had to tell the story of what she went through herself. She got to craft that story. And so the Gospel of Swami Ramdas is this really tremendous book, and I hope all of you can read it. But in that book, as I've said many times, Mother, other than Papa, Mataji, Swamiji, their mother has more ink on her and father's life there than anybody else who's in the book. And once mother started having these, I think it was near Christmas or just after Christmas, this all Papa told Swamiji to stop writing, to stop. And that's where the book ends too, is just before mother starts into her experiences. So she started in February 24th. Of 1958, and somewhere in the late 57, the book stops. Maybe early 58, but it stops. And Swamiji said that Papa told him to stop at that time. Now, Swamiji was working on intuition and his own God understanding, that he always saw Mother as great, but he still needed confirmation, I think. So they saw Mother again in 68. And remember, Mother went there thinking, oh my gosh, what am I getting myself into? Do I dare go back there? Because she had been through such turmoil there. That was the word that Swamiji used. I love that phrase when he uses it. But, you know, she instead absolutely had a fantastic time in 68 there. She really, really enjoyed being there, and she was well received. Now, we all know from Mother's own teachings that she hadn't attained the highest state yet. In late 60s, it was close. But somewhere in the early 70s, David and I have talked about this over the years, and Mother always said it took her 16 years, so you've heard all this, I know. And you can count from 1954 when she had the first experience of nirvikalpa samadhi, and that would put her at 1970 to when she attained her full realization. And her tapes might show that. They might take a little more study to see the differences. And then the other one was 58 when she went through the crucifixion experience, and you count that, and that becomes 74. David liked that, or, you know, honestly, I said it to him more than he said it, if he said it at all. He came right when Mother definitely had her full state of consciousness, Sahaja Samadhi state. And you see the smiles and the pictures of her at that time, and she has a really particular smile, and her eyes are more piercing. But that's not a good word to use because there's so much compassion in them. So 77 comes, and Mother goes back to the ashram again as a fully realized person. Everyone who has the eyes to see can see that she was something very special. She had attained something great. Swamiji had been around Mataji and Papa and many other saints and knew what this, as Mother used to say, the fabric that, out of which I would make my own life. He could sense that. So Mother tells him all the things. She spends time, sits down with him and tells him the story of what happened in her time in 58 through, you know, the early years with, you know, before Papa died. So 5 years there, really, 58, 1960, she came out of it, pretty much launched and set up on her own and stable and loving and being gratitude to Papa. So somewhere between, you know, those last years in the 1950s, she was going through difficult times. Swamiji puts the book, The Gospel of Swami Ram Dass, together after Mother is there in 77. Within 1 year, he's put it all together into a book and sent Mother a copy. I was just so grateful to Mother for showing this to me. I opened up a book of Mother's that was received from the ashram, the one that is the first one or very close to it, and Swamiji had signed it and dated it. And it was early, I think, January of 79. And I started thinking, Mother was there in the fall of 77. The book actually got published in late 78. Swamiji did that book with soul, and he clothed it in all the other remarkable stories around Papa. But he did that as a gift to Mother. When she left the ashram and then 77, he said, you must write this down. It may start a war, a religious war, but it must be said. It must be written down. You must write your book. So what does he do but spend that next year getting that book ready? And it's one of the best testimonials for what Mother was going through and what she was like as a personality and what she was like as a student of her own master. And what she was like as a saint and a person whose very aura lifted people up and remarked upon. She met so many saints in 68 who were just flabbergasted with her when she walked in the room, many of them would see her in a ball of light, or would see the light in the room change. You know, Mother said about Sister Mother Teresa that there are stories of her. I know Mother said that her skin glowed, that she had a light about her. She talked about it in that way. But there are stories that when the cameramen are doing their light readings that were at one level low, and then she comes in the room and there all of a sudden there's more light. These are the kind of things that are evidence, are giving evidence of a saint's state. These are subtle lights, but sometimes they come into the physical realm too. So the realm of the astral world, the unseen world, and this one are enmeshed. They're not discrete boundaries. It's not just jump over here to this. There's even a little bit of overlap between them. If we think about it, we can see things from, and we can feel things from that realm. Vision is a great distractor. That's why the eyes are considered the thieves on the cross. Vision is a tremendous tool here on this earth, that for a person trying to live here and operate in the chemical soup that we live in, vision is unsurpassed as far as being necessary and important, and the only thing that keeps species alive of our types. Many other species are blind, I know, but they have, a lot of them have sonic ways of seeing the world. But vision also makes us kind of haughty. We think we know everything because we can see it. But can we really see? And does it distract us? We need to close our eyes. We need to not be affected by sounds. We need to withdraw insufficiently where the sound do go away. The sounds go away. The heart can slow down. Breathing, you don't notice. You can quiet the mind, which is the source of so much of this. And you can see into that realm that houses so much of what we need in this world and that we interact with here. That other world that touches on this one is completely occupied with keeping things in stability in this world. So much is going on behind the scenes continuously. You can listen to Mother, you can listen to Master, you can listen to David. They are there. You can reach out to them. Now it's almost 8:30. So I think we'll just stop there. If anyone has any comments, of course, you're welcome to do so now, but I don't want to go too much longer. Let's say our closing prayer. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel
the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging
in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind
and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant
with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my
communion with thee.
I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Larry.
Thanks for coming.
We'll thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Helpful.
I'll play a little music on the way out. Have a lovely evening.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.